and welcome to minute 44 of season 3 of Over a Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action movie Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Travis Bowe of the Real Comics Heroes podcast. Welcome back, Travis.
Thanks for having me back.
Always a pleasure, always a pleasure. Just keep the Maydays, you know, to one syllable at a time. So, minute 44 begins with Holly stating the obvious and ends with McClane giving a report on Channel 9. So, yesterday we ended things with Carl getting a little bit frustrated, to say the least, about the fact that his brother just turned up dead and he wanted to scour the entire building and find John McClane and destroy him. And things ended with Holly and Ellis looking on from the outside room into her office, basically, to watching the two of them. And, you know, she basically says to Ellis says to her beforehand, what do you think? And her response is, something's wrong. You know, she's stating the obvious for sure.
Yeah.
You know, I think Ellis is a little too close to her for comfort, especially given the fact that he was breaking a few laws at the beginning of this movie. Sure. You know, he seems too much like a predator. You know, he's definitely done some inappropriate things that one should not do in the workplace.
For sure. Yeah.
You know, he could easily be sued for sexual harassment here. No question about that. And especially now also, he's just getting a little too close. And then the two of them have a little bit of a conversation here. And so she says to him, something's wrong. And he goes, cops. And she answers, John. And Ellis goes, John? Oh, Christ. He could fuck this whole thing up. What does he think he's doing? His job. His job is 3,000 miles away. Without him, we still have a chance. We might be able to get out of here. Tell that to Takagi. So it's a nice little conversation between the two of them. You know, the debate between them, you know, shows, first of all, I think it's very important because it shows that Holly is completely on John's side here.
Right.
You know, that she trusts her husband. You know, we had the earlier in the week, we had the fact that it said in the script, you know, that she got his sense of humor. She saw his sense of humor in the fact that Tony was sitting there in the thing. So, I mean, that's something that was never really acted upon in the final cut anyway. But this is a good way to show that she trusts her husband and that she thinks that he is doing the right thing. And that if he were to give himself up, he would be in big trouble. You know, which is something that Ellis doesn't understand. You know, I guess being a cop's wife for 11 years helps. Mm. You know.
Yeah, no, I like that he has her support throughout this.
Yes.
Yeah, then that is important, I think.
Yeah,
it's so that, few people do, so.
Yeah, it's something that always disappointed me that in the, you know, the third, fourth, and fifth movies of the series, you know, she's not there anymore. They get into a fight and whatever. I think that was just extraneous. I don't think they really needed it.
Right.
But, you know, at least for the first two movies, she's there by his side, which works. So, I mean, one of the things that Ellis says here is bullshit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
What do you know about the word bullshit? I love surprising you, Travis. You know what to expect with me, and I still am able to surprise you.
Well, these tangents are funny that this is what you decided to do a little history lesson on. I don't know what the true etymology of bullshit is. No, I'd love to find out, though.
Okay, and you shall, along with everyone else. So it's sometimes referred to as bullshite or bullcrap.
Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes people will shorten it and just say bull, or sometimes they'll say BS. And in England, people will say bollocks, which is pretty much the same.
Okay.
Same phrase. It essentially means nonsense, especially as a rebuke in response to communication or actions viewed as deceptive, misleading, disingenuous, unfair, or false. Okay, it is usually used as an interjection, but it can be used in numerous parts of speech, and it can carry a wide variety of meanings. You know, sometimes a person who excels at communicating nonsense will be referred to as a bullshit artist instead of calling them a liar.
Yeah.
You know, which is a simpler way of doing it. Okay, it's usually used in a depreciatory sense. Okay, for instance, if you're referring to the fact that, you know, someone's a liar, so a liar tells untruth, but a bullshit aims to convey a certain impression of themselves without being concerned about whether anything at all is true, because it may be.
Yeah.
You're never quite sure if the person's telling the truth or not when you're talking about it. Okay. If someone screams out the term bullshit, as Ellis did earlier in this, you know, in the show. So it's a measure of dissatisfaction with something or somebody, and it doesn't necessarily say whether the person believes that they're telling the truth or not.
Right.
You know, it's not a comment on the truth. It's just outraging. Now, I'm going to split this up into two different sections. Where do you think the term bull came from? And then at what time did people start using the term bull? And when did it change to being bullshit?
I don't know. Just total guess. I'd say probably bull probably goes back to, I guess, the 1700s, 1700s.
Okay, you're very close with that. It goes from the 17th century.
Okay.
So it's the 1600s. Yeah. Okay, that's pretty good. And when do you think bullshit started being used?
That feels slightly more of a Western. You know, I'd say more in the 1800s, early 1800s.
Okay, well, according to the research that I did, it was starting to be used during World War I,
wow.
Around 1915. And it became a very prevalent part of British and American
and
slang.
To mean nonsense, basically? Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. To mean nonsense.
Interesting, yes. You know, and, how they arrive at this word, you know, this animal excrement equals nonsense. Why isn't it horseshit? Which horseshit does also, I mean, you can kind of use them interchangeably. So
correct. I was just about to say that you jumped the gun on that one, but that's fine. So during World War II, it became even more popular to use that phrase. The word bull itself is probably from a French word called bull, which means fraud or deceit.
Okay,
which then would make more sense as to why they would use it. I don't know why the fits
right.
That I'm not really sure about that one. Okay, but the term horse is a near synonym. Okay, and there are some places, especially in Australia, where they call it bull dust.
I like that.
Instead, yeah. Okay, so there is a TV show that is known as Penn and Teller Bullshit. Right. And that is a show that debunks many common beliefs and often criticizes specific people's comments. So someone once asked Penn Jillette why they actually chose the name. And he said, because you can actually get sued for saying someone's a liar, but you can't get sued if you say they're just talking bullshit.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. There's also a, I believe there's a game show now called, isn't there? With Howie Mandel,
sure.
I believe where the idea is that the contestants have to make up a story as to what the truth is of some answer to something.
We used to play a card game in study hall when I was in high school. You know, trying to remember how it's played.
Yes.
But
two aces, three twos, four fours.
Yes. Yes.
You know, everyone, you go in order. And you put down the cards, and if you believe that the person is lying, then you say bullshit, and then they have to reveal the cards. And you know, if they were telling you the truth that they really put down that number of cards, you have to take the pile. And if they were lying, then they have to take the whole pile. And obviously, the object is to get rid of all your cards.
That was fun game.
So yeah, it was a fun game. That's true. What movie? There was a movie where there was like a family playing it. I'm trying to remember what it was. And I remember that you had certain people screaming bull that you wouldn't expect them to say.
Yeah, it was like a family,
you know,
not a family not, comedy, oh. but it was like a family. Yeah, I can picture it, but I can't think of what movie that was.
It was How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. There you go.
Lose a Guy. Huh. All right.
Yeah. How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days was with Matthew McConaughey and
Kate Hudson.
What's her name? Kate Hudson. And I think the father wasn't it the guy from the 70s show?
Red Foreman?
Was it?
Or I mean
I can't remember the guy's name either right now. No, I don't think it was. It wasn't him. It was someone else playing it. But it was a fun scene. You know, I'll link to it so that people can see the scene. It's, it's a fun scene of seeing them play that, you know, getting familiar with the family. not a way that you would expect people in general to do that, but it still works. The idea that Ellis says his job's 3,000 miles away, so obviously he's just rounding off because, you know, it's really 2,789 miles between L.A. to New York, which with the internet is a very simple thing to find out. How long do you think it would take to drive at a normal pace of 60, 65, whatever? What would be your guess?
I think you could
if you were to drive it straight without stopping.
I'd say you could do it in 5 to 6 days. Say 6 days.
You can do it apparently in 41 hours.
Sure, sure.
If you were to go straight, you know. Most people don't do that. And how long do you think the flight is?
It's probably a 3-hour flight. Is it?
Okay. It's a 5-hour flight. Again, this is all rounding off because it's different, you know. It's not all specifically whatever. And then the shot changes and we get to see John climbing up 3 flights of stairs. You know, like, what's the point of showing him go up 3 flights? Is that to tell us that the elevator doesn't go that close to the...
That would make sense. You know, you wouldn't have an elevator go that high up. And maybe just to show that there is this area, because this is going to be a scene of a fight scene later.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know.
What's really funny to me is he makes a lot of noise as he's running up those stairs. You know, you'd think he would try to be a little bit more, a little quieter with what he's doing here. Not really sure. But then he gets up and we get a great panning shot of the nighttime LA skyline. You know, it's just amazing to look at. I mean, I don't recognize anything there. I'm not an LA person anyway. I'm assuming people from LA would recognize some things, some landmarks here or there.
If it was a daytime shot, I'm sure it'd be easier to pick out things. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. And then what's really funny is McClane is standing there, and after a few seconds, he like jerks to the side, you know, as if he maybe thinks he's and like points his gun somewhere. Maybe he thinks he's heard something. But we're not really sure what startled him. Could have just been a bird.
Maybe clicked in that he hasn't secured this area. He doesn't know that there's not a sentry up here, you know. It's like it suddenly remembers what the threat is.
Right. It could be. And then we see 2 flashing lights that are nearby. On the left-hand side, we see like a strobe light that's on top of the building. And then on the right-hand side, we see like a red light flashing. Okay, so what do you think those lights are for?
Just air traffic, you know, signaling that there's buildings this high up for, you know, nighttime flights not keeping buildings away, essentially, or keeping planes and helicopters away. I'm sure there's a significance to the flashing red or the white. I'm not sure, but
right. Okay, well, that's what I'm here for, to tell you about this thing. So when do you think the strobe light was invented?
I'm going to...
A strobe light is basically a light that's flashing, you know, every few seconds.
Be super handy with, like, commercial shipping and air travel. I'll go 1920.
1931. By Harold Eugene Doc Edgerton. He was using a flashing lamp to try to make an improved stroboscope while he was trying to study moving objects. Okay, which eventually resulted in being able to take really amazing photographs of objects that are moving really fast, like a bullet. You know, while they're doing that. Okay, in the 1960s, it became very popular in the club scene. You know that they would use strobe lights, and it was. Do you know why it was popular in the 60s? 60s and 70s.
I would assume with the drug culture, just.
Yes, yeah. It would enhance the effects of LSD.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. Now, there is also the danger that sometimes strobe lights can trigger seizures in people who have photosensitive epilepsy. Yeah. So that's a little bit of a problem there. So what you have also is aviation obstruction lighting. Okay, that's the idea of having... You know, there are laws as to what type of lights you need to have on certain buildings of a certain height because of flights. Okay, so it's used to enhance the visibility of structures or fixed objects, which may conflict with the safe navigation of aircraft. Obstruction lighting is commonly installed on towers, buildings, and even fences located in areas where aircraft may be operating in low altitudes. Okay, these lighting systems commonly employ one or more high-intensity strobe or LED devices, which can be seen by pilots from many miles away. Okay, and they use red lamps that are constantly illuminated or that are turning on and off slowly in a cycle every few seconds in order to alert pilots that there is some sort of object in front of them. Okay, and the white ones are usually white xenon flash lamps, which are used in order to also make sure that the pilot can actually see what's going on. So, it makes a lot of sense. Safety while flying.
I always misread the strobe lights as later we see Al's perspective when he looks up at the building, and then they're... I always misread what he sees as what I thought he was seeing as machine gun fire is probably the strobe lights.
Well, we'll have to see in the next few weeks how that plays out. I'll keep an eye out for that one.
Yeah.
And, you know, John looks around to make sure that everything is clear, and then he picks up the CV and puts it to his mouth. And says, "Mayday, mayday, anyone copying? Channel 9, terrorists have seized the Nakatomi building and are holding at least 30 people hostage. I repeat, unknown number of terrorists, 6 or more, armed with automatic weapons at Nakatomi Plaza." Okay, so as he's doing this, we see a shot inside of Holly's office. You know, there are two pens on the side there. We see a tape dispenser. There is a picture of John Jr., which is what actually tells us that is once again Holly's, Holly's desk. And I love the way they do this because we see a walkie-talkie just like sitting on the desk.
Yeah.
You know, it isn't that Hans is holding it or Carl or anything like that. The idea here is that there is a walkie-talkie that is just speaking, and so we get to see, you know, they're telling us that they're able to hear everything that John is saying at this point, you know, which is really, really, really cool. So one of the things that he says is Mayday, right?
Right.
So what do you know about the phrase Mayday?
I know I've heard the origin of the phrase before, but I can't remember where that specific, you know, those two words, I don't remember what is significant about them.
Right. Okay. So Mayday is an emergency procedure word used internationally as a distress signal in voice procedure radio communications. All right. Now, what's interesting is that so it's used to signal some sort of life-threatening emergency, primarily by aviators or mariners, But in some countries, local organizations such as firefighters, police forces, and transportation organizations also use it, right? You're supposed to say it three times in a row, like Beetlejuice, right? Beetlejuice, 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 Mayday, 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 during the initial emergency declaration to prevent it being mistaken for some similar sounding phrase under noisy conditions, and also to distinguish an actual Mayday call from a message about a Mayday call.
Huh.
Okay, so apparently John doesn't do that right here because he only says Mayday twice.
Okay, yeah.
You know, maybe that's why, you know, tomorrow they're going to want to arrest him.
Right.
Because he's not saying Mayday properly. When do you think they started using the word Mayday as a distress call?
I would guess. I mean, I'm not certain when, like, radios like this, you know, started being used. But I'm guessing in the 19, I don't know if it'd be around for World War One, but so I'll say 1930.
Okay, it was 1920s. You were very close with that one. By a man named Frederick Stanley Mockford, who was the officer in charge of radio at Croydon Airport in England. Okay, now what's really interesting, you mentioned earlier that you don't know where they got the term Mayday from, right? So he actually proposed the term because it was very similar to a French word, Mayday, M-A-I-D-E-S-D-E-Z, excuse me, which means help me.
Okay.
All right. And so therefore he decided to Anglicanize it and just say Mayday instead. Now, they did a lot of tests to see if the term works, and up until then, they were using Morse code,
sure,
in which the signal then was SOS. But when dealing with voice communication, SOS was less effective, so they were looking for some new way of saying it, so they decided that they're going to go with Mayday instead.
Huh.
Okay. Now, what they say here also is that making a false distress call is a criminal offense in many countries, punishable by a fine, restitution, and possible imprisonment. Hmm. So who knows? Maybe that'll come up sometime later this week.
Right.
Maybe. You never know. Now, what's funny is that he says here that there are 30 hostages. Okay. So first of all, I would think that there are more than 30 people working in the Nakatomi building that were at this Christmas party. You know, I never counted how many people are actually in the party, but you think that there are more than 30.
I don't know. Yeah.
You know, obviously you never counted.
This is an American office of a Japanese company. Maybe, you know, this isn't the main part of the company, I guess. So this is just a small. I don't know.
Okay, and also then he says terrorists six or more, right? So, again, as we counted earlier this week, he knows of at least eight.
Yeah.
But he only counted six on his arm, so, okay, that's, that's why he's saying there's only six.
Right.
But in a little while, in a few weeks, he's actually going to say that he knows that there are at least 12, and he doesn't really see more of them by then, but we'll keep an eye out for that. And that's pretty much how this minute ends, midway through John's report, you know, to Channel 9 Mayday. So do you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
No, not really. I did notice that, like, going back to the Ellis, like, seeing him, like, Hart Bochner is an actor that I only know from this. And I know that he does a voice in Batman Mask of the Phantasm. But other than that, like, I don't – never really saw that. I guess I've seen him in Supergirl. I didn't know that, you know, till looking at the list of what he's in. I've probably seen a couple other things, but nothing I could, you know, identify. But
right.
Just kind of one of those guys, I guess.
I think he was on TV. Wasn't he, like, on some TV show, like Hotel or something like that for many years?
I don't know.
If I remember correctly. I don't really know him that much from movies either. I mean, okay. He was in 1979, the movie Breaking Away. He was in that one also.
Oh, okay.
He played the mean guy.
Sure, I could see that. Yeah.
You know, like the rich
Right.
the rich guy making fun of them, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Actually, no, I was wrong. He wasn't in Hotel. He was in War and Remembrance. He took over for Jan Michael Vincent in the role of Byron Henry in War and Remembrance, which was the sequel to The Winds of War.
Okay.
But yeah, no, he doesn't really have a he has a nice career, but not a very prolific one. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But we'll always remember him as Ellis. What can you
Yeah.
do? Right. So there are only a few small discrepancies in this minute also. During the conversation between Holly and Ellis, so one he refers to the police as police instead of cops. Again, doesn't really make a difference. And then one of the things he says to Holly says, how about his job? That he's doing his job. So he says his job is 3,000 miles away. Without him, they might let us go. At least we have a chance. And then Holly responds, tell that to Mr. Takagi. So, first of all, the fact that Ellis in the script believes that if John wasn't messing things up, they would let them go. He's still pretty high, I
Yeah.
guess.
That reminds me of something that when he said, I think it might be after he says bullshit, he says that he's gonna mess this up for us,
That's right.
or
No, he
he's gonna
says
mess up the plan.
he's gonna
Yeah.
fuck this whole thing up.
That one little line like makes me, it almost sounds like he could be an inside man. You know, like
Ooh,
in that
I knew
it,
you were going there when you started saying that. Yeah,
yeah.
but that, yeah.
And it's interesting that this movie doesn't have an inside man element. I don't know if that'd be, if it's better or worse. I don't know, but I just him, the way he says that, it does make you wonder for a second, like, does he know more than he should, or but
Well, I definitely agree with you on that. It would have made things very interesting if you had an inside guy. But I like the way that Ellis, at least, is not the inside guy
yeah.
because his character has a great, I guess you can sort of say,
Yeah,
arc later on
right.
with the type of things that he does.
Yeah.
And had he been part of them, so, well, again, if he would have been part of them, he would have given away the fact that John was Holly's husband.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but yeah, that's an interesting idea. And I also like the fact that Holly calls him Mr. Takagi, as opposed to saying tell that to Takagi.
Yeah.
It's more formal when she says the Mr., but if she just says it in the way then in the final, in the final cut,
Yeah.
it works well by her saying tell that to Takagi, meaning that okay, she's very close to Takagi.
Yeah.
They have a closer relationship. So I think that works out well.
Yeah, she definitely respects him.
For sure. All right. So every Thursday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Holiday Edition, where once again, my guest or myself will give a little story anecdote about some adventure or misadventure that happened to one of us at some point in our lives over some sort of holiday. So, Travis, you got another story for us?
Yeah, I do. I have another little Christmas story. Again, my parents playing mean tricks on me. I was would have been the 1995 Christmas, and all I wanted was Batman Forever on VHS. And Christmas morning came around. I got a Batman Forever, a couple action figures. I had two posters for my room. And I think some like school like folders, just various other Batman Forever merchandise, no movie. So I held it together, like I didn't, throw a fit, I didn't complain, but I mean I was, a little heartbroken that I didn't get the one thing that I really wanted. I got things adjacent, to the movie, but and we go over to some friend's house for our like, friend Christmas get together that night, and that family had gotten it for me. So I think
Oh, I thought you were going to say they got it for their kid, and
oh
that would have really pissed you off.
right. No, they got it for me, I think because my parents knew that if we got it for him Christmas morning, he would just want to stay home and watch, watch the movie and not do anything else that day. So they strategically, I think, orchestrated this, real mean prank that I frankly have never forgiven them for. So
you still haven't forgiven them after,
no way, man.
You know, was it
25 years?
That came out in 1995, so it's 27 years.
No.
All right, that's
cruel and.
Well, let's put it this way: if you can forgive them for leaving you on a train that gets into an accident, I think you're good with it.
Right. Yeah.
Just making references to stories that Travis told last season. So if you haven't listened, you can go back and listen to his minutes.
Yeah.
He had minutes 81 through 85 of Planes, Trains, Automobiles, where we had some great discussions.
Train accident survivor right here.
Yes. Yes. With help from someone you wouldn't expect.
That's right.
And if you go to the Facebook, you can even see a copy of an article that talks about it. All right. Do you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Sure. Check out Real Comic Heroes. It's Real Comic Heroes on Instagram and Twitter. And check out that show if you like comic book movies.
Excellent. And finding me once again is quite simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So, Travis, you feel like coming back again?
I do.
And possibly getting arrested in order to, talk about another day about Die Hard?
Absolutely, I do.
All right. Excellent. So, we'll be back tomorrow. And until then, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.